Hey guys, thank you so much for joining me today. I have a great conversation for you. I am joined today by Ben Wilson, who is the founder of the How to Take Over the World podcast. The podcast does exactly what you think it does. It actually distills the tactics and the philosophies and the individual biographies of good and great people throughout history and incorporates Ben's unique sense of all of those topics. We talked about a lot in this conversation. We talked about modern day politics. We talked about the male mental health crisis that's going on. We talked about the difference between goodness and greatness and the blessings of fatherhood. And it was just a great conversation. And I was always, you know, very excited to talk to Ben because I really like his podcast. And I'm sure many of you have heard of it. And if you haven't heard of it, go ahead and check it out. And here is my podcast with Ben Wilson. All right, well, I'm here with Ben Wilson, the founder of the How to Take Over the World podcast. Ben, it's really great to talk to you again for a number of reasons. You've been pretty prolific since the last time we've spoke. You know, we have never met in person, but I've listened to your podcast enough to know that we've stumbled upon very similar conclusions about a lot of things, and we've expressed them differently in the way we've approached sharing them. You know, just different, a different philosophical execution. But it's kind of crazy. You can have friends for the longest periods in your life. And I have a few who, you know, we were great friends growing up, you know, we spent all the time in the world together. But now we basically disagree on everything. Our choices of lifestyle are wholly different. And you can't even really recognize our relationship as being symbiotic, except for the fact that we have this great history. And then through the internet, I was recommended your podcast, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. And I found so much common ground, and it's the one sobering piece of positive press you can give to social media and the internet, right? It connects people in this way. And that has kind of drawn me into wanting to make a quick opening question to you. You are recently now a father, and I think that this is one of the more interesting dynamics that presents itself in the topic that you have made yourself kind of an expert at, which is greatness and how it contrasts with goodness. You know, you talk about in one of your podcasts recently, you talked about the founding fathers. And I remember one of the things you talked about was one of George Washington's great acts of kindness. And we see goodness and greatness as sort of dichotomized sometimes. You know, people can be good or they can be great. Fatherhood seems like it's a combination of both. And I'm just wondering if you want to just open up with a comment about that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's good to talk again. I have a ton of respect for your music and for what you do. As a failed pianist, I have a lot of respect for real musicians. Fatherhood is interesting. I'll say this about fatherhood. You know, there's a lot of talk these days about falling fertility rates and failing sexual dynamics and how difficult it is to find a partner, get married, have children. And, you know, some people view parenthood as like an act of rebellion or something like that. And it's extremely rewarding. It's extremely difficult. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in or thinking about becoming a parent, like, do it for the right reason. Do it because you find someone you love and because you have that innate desire to, like, create a family with them, and not because, you know, I've expressed some interest in the past about raising geniuses. I have an episode on that of raising genius, and that's certainly an interesting thing to think about, but that's not enough to sustain a family, you know? Like if you, yeah. So anyway, I think I've had this thought a lot about my son, more so than my daughters, which is I love them very much. And I always look at my sons and I think, I love you, but you're going to have to find your own way. Right. And so I think fatherhood is more an act of goodness because your children are going to have to find their own way anyway. And so I think it's more incumbent on a father to just be a source of like a good presence and a source of love, and like that rock that children can fall back on. And if they have greatness within themselves, they're gonna find that anyway. And yeah, you push them a little bit in certain ways, but I really think, you know, that was my relationship with my father, and the relationship I'm trying to create with my sons is just to be a source of love for them.
Yeah, I think that's somewhat of the answer I wanted, but I think, like, you know, there's definitely this relationship that you find that some of the most abused and neglected children grow up to be just unbelievable specimens. I mean, you can think, there's lots of examples, of course, that you and I are aware of. Sometimes I think about Julius Caesar in this context. I think about the fact that, you know, his father wasn't really around much, or if he didn't really know his father very much at all, it sounds like. And grew up in the seedy part of town, kind of the school of hard knocks, you know, doesn't really have the money to pay off the pirates. You know, there's that angle of things. There's the, you know, the Alexander side of things, which is a whole, you know, other question. But I'm also kind of wondering with this question, you know, say that the, you know, someone like Genghis Khan, for example, who the amount of offspring he had is often sometimes that you will sort of hear historians kind of murmuring about, that is sort of the proof. This is one of the great proofs of his greatness, right? That we instinctively take fatherhood as having this, you know, just it is representative of status and ability and sexual prowess, all of these different things. I definitely think that when I look at history at large, though, I see like a whole two sets of things. I see like the prolific father, great figure, and I see the modern, you know, high-functioning lawyer or investment banker or someone who is a great artist who is just driven, and they can't even think about having kids because they are spending 90 hours a week for 30 years doing the best they possibly can at their thing, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that there's a tension there that, like, some people consciously and proactively make a decision to avoid having kids, really sometimes because of that. I think that the recent trend of women having less children when they're more educated is proof of that fact. I'm wondering what you think about it in, like, in terms of people that you've talked about. Do you see that they had a any sort of a natal instinct? Do you think about it through that lens at all? Or do you think that this is just kind of, you know, if they had kids, it was coincidental, or, you know, just a step along the way?
Well, I don't know. I don't have a grand theory of this because I can think of tons of examples and counterexamples, right? So, for example, Isaac Newton famously never marries, never has children, never even has any relationships. One of his few very good friends, John Locke, tries to get him to date a little bit, and he like writes him off as a friend and says, "I never want to talk to John Locke again. He's tried to mix me up with women," he says. He's just like so focused on science and physics that like he can't really bring his head up for air enough to have a social life. On the other hand, you look at someone who in some ways is similar, who is Thomas Edison, and similarly, he is similarly devoted to his work, but has his first wife dies, but has two kind of very understanding wives who are kind of always there for him. And so he has just like this bubbling energy in every aspect of his life. So even though he's almost never home, Thomas Edison has all of these children. Because you just get the feeling that he has this like energy and this potency that manifests itself both in infertility of invention and of literal children. Same with, you know, we were talking about Bach before we started recording. I'm doing an episode on Johann Sebastian Bach right now, and he has 20 children in his life, despite you know, being one of the most prolific composers of all time and having this really demanding work life. So I don't know what conclusions are to be drawn there, other than I think if you're going to be that focused, you can't think about it or focus on it that much. You know, this idea of having children, like, it seems to me either these people, they're so creative and involved in their work life that they never have children, never marry, never settle, whatever, or it's that they find such a stable, supportive home life that they're able to kind of have children as a byproduct without having to think too much about it, frankly.
Yeah, I like that. One of the words you used there, I think, was kind of perfect for setting up the vector here. You used the word fertility for a male, which kind of like impose, if you really think about it from the, like, you know, 3,000-foot perspective, it wouldn't just be all your outputs as a creator or a destroyer or a product manager, like all of the things we think about as the terrestrial greatness. It, I mean, you could apply fertility to someone like, you know, Bach, and you could just talk about his output as being his fertility. But fertility also has this dual meaning where, like, your output totally, you know? And that, like, biological output is one of those outputs. So I like that for understanding. I think that, like, maybe it's because of how things have gotten in the last 10 or 15 years with fertility rates that we have such a more conscious process about this. Maybe it was a significantly less conscious process before. It was just kind of what you do. There's less of a, this is what you do feeling at this point. So... I definitely think that that's part and parcel there. Like, it kind of, it dovetails nicely with something else that I wanted to kind of bring you to kind of immediately. It's kind of related, but, you know, I've had enough time to listen to your podcast that you seem to identify, you're really good at identifying qualities that make the thing good or great, and you're really good at identifying the, obviously, the historical deeds of any of the people that you speak about. But I want to put something to you, and I want you to tell me what you think about it, because it might be a nice segue and a nice way to understand good and greatness. When you're studying physics, when you're trying to figure out force and, you know, just do basics and velocity and stuff, and in the subject of vectors, there's the magnitude and the direction of a force, right? So we have the magnitude is the size of the thing, and the direction is whether it's south, west, east, north. You know, you can put it into individual qubits and you can look at things like that. I've always felt that this was a great metaphor for looking at human beings through the lens of goodness and greatness, because I think you can be in the great man theory of the world, have significant greatness in the wrong direction. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, 100%.
Yeah, so that's something that I think is very, very difficult to talk about, but that should be discussed openly. I think you can have greatness qualities, which would be, let's call that the magnitude of something, and the direction of whatever that thing you're doing is can be significantly bad. And I think that when your podcast, specifically How to Take Over the World, I think a lot of the times when we listen to a podcast like that, we take for granted kind of what the emotional content is of people who maybe are on the receiving end of what we would call greatness. And I'm wondering if you can speak to that, because, I mean, we could talk. I don't know if you have actually done an episode on someone like Adolf Hitler. Did you do an episode on Hitler?
No, I haven't done one on Hitler yet.
Yeah, so that's obviously I'm going to, like, Godwin's law really quick. I'm going very far to the extreme. But there is the receiving end of this stuff that is very, very difficult for anyone who has, you know, been there to process, that you would even use the word great for these things. So first I want you to just respond to the magnitude and direction thing. Do you think I'm onto anything there?
I think that's a great way of thinking of it. The sort of physics of greatness is, and in terms of sort of personal development, you would think of, I think, magnitude as sort of energy, which is also a physics term, right? But the total energy input into an activity. And that's one of my early observations from having done some of these episodes, is the greatest achiever in any given domain is not the most intelligent, although they are almost always extremely intelligent, but it's not the most intelligent. You look at someone like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, they're probably not the most intelligent people at their own companies. So it's not the most intelligent. It is usually the most energetic. They are almost always the most energetic person in their domain. And then for direction, you would talk about focus, right? People who dissipate that energy widely can often be very interesting people and do exciting things in their lives, but they're not going to achieve greatness in any one given domain. So yeah, focus and energy, I think, is similar to the idea of magnitude and direction.
Okay, cool. So I'm glad we're on the same page there, because that brings me up to a topic that is more current. I think hopefully with the listener primed, whatever their political priors are to this, and understanding, you know, with the proper precautions in place, you did recently do an episode on Donald Trump. And so was this, I don't know, you had done some episodes on contemporary figures before, but this was probably the most contemporary and obvious topic for you to pick, was it not?
Yeah, I try and mostly do dead people.
Yeah.
especially because it's a little safer, right? People don't tend to have the sort of emotional reaction to a Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great that they do to a Donald Trump or a Vladimir Putin. But I did it just because I wanted to understand this person, Trump, of what makes this guy tick and who is he really? And you hear things about his background, but I guess I didn't have a feel for the whole. And so I was really excited to kind of learn who he was as a person.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the other things when you're doing he is not done. It's not like he was out of office 10 years ago or anything. The most effective or the most important things that he ever does could still be coming. I think what we have with Trump and that people are being forced to see is a perfect example of magnitude and direction. Because I think there are pieces of individual media, just for example, that in my mind, in the history books, are going to be, even if he goes down as being a cringe, unlikable person, I mean, the photo of him after being shot, I mean, that is going to maybe be up there with any of the greatest, you know, iconic American photos you can name, you know, Iwo Jima, you know, right. What is it, you know, the whatever you want to throw out there. What's your sense about the media effect? You know, the clips, all of these things that are really, really here with him and present that will make the, the historification of him very different from the other people you've covered.
Well, you know, this is someone who, when he graduates from college, he ends up going into his father's business, but he flirts with the idea of going to film school at USC. Ultimately decides against it, but has maintained a lifelong interest in theater and film. There's this really interesting interview. I obviously was crunching a lot of game tape, watching a lot of interviews with him. And there's one interview he does with Steve Bannon, where Bannon is trying to talk about how bad crime was in the 80s. And I can't remember why, but Bannon brings up a specific year. He's like, oh, you know, in 85... you know, you did XYZ, and Trump says, oh yeah, 85, that's the year that Andrew Lloyd Webber was living in Trump Tower and invited me to the opening of the opening performance of The Phantom of the Opera. And Bannon goes, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And anyways, you know, crime was horrible in New York in 85. And he goes, no, wait, did you not hear me? The opening, the very first show of Phantom of the Opera, I was there by the personal invitation of Andrew Lloyd Webber. And he just like can't move past it because Donald Trump is so obsessed with theater. I think he loves it to an extent that would shock most people. I think most people don't understand his attachment to drama. And so he has just this unbelievable, natural, dramatic flair and artistic understanding. The guy puts out, I don't know if you saw this picture of him and Zelensky sitting on chairs, kind of knee to knee, at the Vatican for the Pope's funeral. But like, it's this unbelievably dramatic image. He puts out like three or four unbelievably memeable images per week. And so I think, you know, Donald Trump is not a thinking man. He's very much operates by instinct, but his instinct for dramatic moments is like, I can think of, it's really, he's on the level of like Caesar and Napoleon and like a handful of other people throughout history. Obviously he has other foibles, and I'm not saying that he's a great man on their level, but his instinct for the dramatic, I think, is second to none throughout history.
I think that that's true, and I've noticed this about him for a very long time. I think the place it became the most obvious was in the 2015 Republican debates, where like he just brought out a set of conduct that was unheard of, especially right among Republicans. I mean, you can look at those old clips of him with George Bush. You knew watching him that these weren't prepared lines. These were just like a typical angry protagonist with like a very almost dry sense of humor sometimes, bringing what was known to be a different shtick onto stage, right? And when he realized that it was working, he just turned it up to 11. But one of the places where I think like it's actually beyond just his performance, the way he's actually approached doing legislation and the way he's actually approached the things that he wants to be remembered for policy-wise are themselves dramatic.
Well, I think this is both a pro and a con towards him trying to achieve his own goals, is that in some ways, I don't think he cares that much about the substance as long as the drama is there. And so in some ways, it can be a help towards achieving what he wants, because striking dramatic things have a way of drawing attention and have a way of like concentrating the mind. But at the same time, I mean, just look at what has happened with the tariffs, right? It's like one of the most dramatic news cycles in presidential history that you can remember. Crashes the economy, everyone's talking about it, pros and cons. And then he slowly walks them back, and you know, it's not nearly as dramatic of an actual implementation as he had outlined or as he probably wants. And yet, you know, you can look at it from the other perspective, which is he makes this big dramatic announcement of these huge tariffs and everyone freaks out, and then he has to draw them down. And yet what has happened? What has happened is the most dramatic increase in tariffs in American history, maybe at least in the last 80 years. And now it doesn't seem like a big deal because the initial implementation was so dramatic that, you know, it's like he asked for the whole world, and then he came back and said, I'll just take, you know, 1 million square miles. And everyone says, oh, okay. You know, so, I don't know. I think, yes, that does describe his personality, is effectively his flair for the dramatic. And that has both big pros and big cons, I think.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what that's proven for the media of today. I mean, you could make a very good argument that the only reason, you know, places like CNN and MSNBC had a lifeline in the era of legacy media is because he exists. And they can follow him constantly. There's no doubt about it that he has been great for some of these places. And that's just kind of a shocking fact in a world in which we treat the executive powers of our country as what should be a functional role. You know, it's supposed to be more functional than performative. Would you agree with that?
At least, like, that's what we've become habituated to over a long period of time.
Well, I mean, I just looking at it into the context from the founding fathers' eyes. I mean, in the time of the founding fathers, and even for a long time after, the odds that even 1 million people were ever going to see your face, even if you were the president, were kind of low, right? So now we have a president now who, you know, one of the things that I have to say, even on a positive note about him, the man is doing an amount of press that would put any 30-year-old movie star to shame. I mean, it really is completely, this seems like a very conscious process on his part. Part of it is the flooding the zone thing, but I'm just kind of wondering, like, when the presidency swings into something that is so performative, the whole end of it, you know, forget about the policies themselves. I mean, we just discussed a lot of them are, you know, he's swinging at Canada. He wants to invade Greenland. You know, we know all of this stuff. The question is if it transforms the presidency in a way that I don't even want to say is damaging, but is just so different from his predecessors that it kind of maybe negates or overshadows what the actual deep responsibilities of the office are, you know?
Well, I think it all depends on what you think the role of Donald Trump is. Because yes, like most presidents are primarily administrative men there to conduct an administrative role. However, once every couple of generations, someone comes along who sort of redesigns the functioning of the federal government. So, you know, obviously the first person to do this is Washington. You could say it's really kind of Hamilton, but it's the combination of Washington and Hamilton that sort of create how the American government functions at first. And then you have a long line of men who inhabit. Well, then you could say Jefferson actually kind of remodels the functioning of the federal government in some ways. And then you have this sort of long line of presidents who, it's more of an administrative role. And then it's really Lincoln who reimagines the U.S. federal government. And then it proceeds. You have sort of a half reinvention under Woodrow Wilson and then a full reinvention under FDR. And then once again, you have a sort of half reinvention under LBJ. And those tend to be people who have kind of a more artistic sensibility, right? Because they are sort of redesigning and reimagining how this thing operates. But it's interesting because I do think that Donald Trump has that sort of artistic sensibility that some of those men might have, but for whatever reason, it's odd. Like, I don't think he really has a vision for the government, if that makes sense. Like, he's not an FDR. He's breaking things, but I don't see him as the type of person who has that imagination for the government specifically, for whatever reason. I just have trouble seeing Donald Trump actually reimagining the way the government works.
To stick here with the show business line, I mean, I could put this to you, but I mean, I've played in bands a long time. I have my own band. I, you know, was in plays when I was younger, and I, you know, I care a lot about performance and writing. And I can tell you just from knowing, you know, not just people in my line of work, but actors and actresses and producers and writers, it takes a certain kind of psychology and a certain kind of intent to be the writer, and it takes a certain kind of psychology and intent to be a performer. And when you are a writer of something, you know, a TV show I watched recently was Lost. And Lost, I don't know if you know Lost, but it has this very interesting premise to the story that kind of wanders, and by the fourth or fifth season, it seems like it's just in total nonsense land. Because there's an assortment of writers. But each individual episode comes with premises that are very, very interesting. And if you just follow it episode by episode, the vision of each individual episode is great. And then the way the whole season ties together just doesn't make all that much sense sometimes. Sometimes that is the main difference, because when you say creative, I think, like, you know, there's a tendency to think of actors and actresses as being creative. But really what you're seeing is the overall universe creation and thought experiment execution by a writer. And Trump strikes me way more as the actor. And I think that that is part of the reason why he appears to not have a grand plan. And I think that that's right, just given how the tariffs were done, how so many of the other things that have happened here are done. And so that's actually maybe a good lens to segue. So let's kind of take it from there. So some people are the writers, and let's assume that both can be great, and some people are the actors of these things. One of the people that really, really comes to mind when I think about this is Hannibal Barca. When I was doing my episode on him, you know, there was considerable evidence that Hannibal was a one-in-a-million strategic genius, and just on every level on the battlefield, and his political skills were awful. So, I mean, I think that true political skills in that time, maybe it is more performative than I'm actually thinking that it is, but in my mind, you know, grand strategy is sometimes very, very difficult from just the things on the ground that give you the ability to respond, or to just lead an army well and effectively. And, you know, I'm wondering what you think about that. Do we have certain people who are like writers of a grand vision and they happen to be the main character in it, versus maybe people who are just the main character and they don't think about much else?
Well, yes. And of course, the people who define eras are the people who are able to do and be both, right? So your Napoleons, you know, Napoleon first comes to notice not for a bit of generalship, but because of a piece of propaganda that he writes, an essay about colonialism. And he actually starts out as like a hard lefty, as do many of these guys. And but of course, so he has that sort of that writer's sensibility that he's interested in the grand strategy. He's good at the politics. He's good at the writing and the political thinking. But he is, of course, a sort of world great performer as well. And so, like, that's really for generational defining figures. I think for run-of-the-mill greats, you can be either one or the other. You can be a great writer or a great performer.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so like I think that that is maybe core to understanding the phenomena of Trump at the very least. I mean, that I segued you there because I sort of wanted to have you riff on that and see what you came up with. But I mean, if you are the grand performer and you are the type of person who can, he, you know, one of the things he's great at, Trump, is measuring a crowd and just knowing who he's playing to. That is something that a lot of, you know, even people who are really significant performers are not great at. And just the idea that you could be that kind of person and also not know where the plot is going, that is like actually like a really powerful insight to have about people, because it lets you look outside yourself, right? Because if you're the person who can captivate a lot of attention, you have to, like, I mean, in theory, if you want it to be great, if someone wanted to be great, you have to use that attention in a way that is significant for you, you know? And sometimes I think that he does not go beyond thinking, I'm going to tweet this, I know it's going to piss a lot of people off. And his followers kind of became these people who, you know, they like that ethos of, I don't really know what the effect of the thing I'm saying is, but I like pissing people off. And that has its own kind of value within it, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, well, a lot of what ties together all of this, Trump, when he speaks, he always says something. And I think that's such a key to understanding his success, because so many politicians say so much without saying anything, right? You've got these lines, the heart of America has always been courage. It's like, what are you saying right now? And you never ask yourself that about Trump. You never ask, what is he actually saying right now? You always know exactly what he's saying. He's always saying something, right? And I think, like, that's one of the main things that I kind of took away from how to be more like him, is just to always say something. Whenever you're talking, always say something.
You mean like not just anything? Say the thing that like is impactful and that can tell people even where your mind's at.
Yeah, like there's this great writing tip that I've heard, which is when you're writing, just stop and ask yourself, all right, what am I trying to say here? And then just write that.
Yeah.
Because sure. somehow you get caught up in how I should be saying this and the style and all these other thoughts. But when you just stop and ask yourself, what am I trying to say here? That's always the best way to communicate. And Trump is always saying the thing that he's trying to say, if that makes sense.
All right. Point taken. All right. I'm going to have a little segue here. Young men today in the United States, 3 times more likely to overdose, 4 times more likely to commit suicide, and 14 times more likely to be incarcerated than their female peers. You know, I can run down this stuff. I'm going to run down for the listener. I'm sure you're aware of a lot of this. 98% of all mass shooters are male. Males are less likely to graduate from college today than they were 15 years ago, even 10 years ago. We have a crisis of males in this country. And I just, you know, I notice your podcast. I notice the space you're operating in. And I notice the people that respond to your podcast. You are speaking a lot of times to young males or even middle-aged males who are really, really looking to find their way. Have you had any meaningful interactions with members of your audience that have moved you or have confirmed to you why it is you've been doing this podcast?
Yeah, I mean, I get really touching notes all the time about from people who have found a lot of hope and meaning, and they felt like their life was kind of on a dead-end course and have turned it around after listening to How to Take Over the World, which is interesting, right? Because generally the type of people who are headed for deaths of despair, suicide, overdose, are not the type of people that you think might end up in greatness, on the other hand. But I just think, even if, especially for men, even if you end up as a soldier, you know, someone who ends up, you know, dead on the battlefield in the army of Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar, the reason that you were there and the thing that inspired and motivated you was not being the soldier, but was the journey of Alexander and Caesar. And so, you know, even if that's not like your path, I think people find themselves inspired by it nevertheless and find it motivating and find meaning in it.
That is, I mean, I 100% agree with that, but that the thing that you just explained is super duper powerful, because what it actually is a proof of one of the things that drew many people to the ancient battlefield. I mean, what is it you sell young men on, you know, 2,300 years ago about going to fight off the great king of Persia? It's adventure, it's camaraderie, it's bravery, it's all of these things that, like, today, what are the actual analogs for? What where is this available, you know?
Well, and all of our attachments are supposed to be to these impersonal ideas. You know, you can look at the roots of this starting in patriotism, but I think there is this deep, especially male, but broadly human need to attach yourself to a man. And there's just something so beautiful and inspiring about that relationship.
To another man, to be clear, another man, you mean?
Yes, to another man.
Okay,
all right. That's right. You know, like there's this great story during the Civil War between Caesar and Pompey, where this boat is taken and Pompey is going through. He's okay, all you base level soldiers, all you oarsmen, you're going to be sold into slavery, and you know, the rest of you, you're going to receive some sort of punishment, and you ship captain, obviously you're of good aristocratic breeding, and so you can have forgiveness, you have your freedom, you can go. And I forget the guy's name, but he's one of Caesar's ardent followers, one of his lieutenants, and he says to Pompey, I'm afraid that it is the policy of Caesar's men to grant clemency but not to receive it. Pulls out a knife and stabs himself in the chest and kills himself. And you just think, okay, that's such a beautiful moment and shows that sort of attachment and that sort of passion that someone like Caesar can inspire. And I think we now find that sort of power imbalance somehow off-putting in this day and age. And we're only concerned about the dangers of power and have no eye for the beauty of power. And so I think that explains like a lot of the listlessness that many of us feel. Like we seek to attach ourselves to that kind of person in life.
I think that is a patriotic point there, to be very clear with that, because I mean, you know, you'll have Cato wandering the battlefields where every Roman is dead, and you know, he hates seeing Romans kill Romans, and Julius Caesar doesn't like it either. But when it's Celts, he has no problem killing men, women, and children, apparently. You know? So I think what's being voiced there a lot of the time is Caesar's treatment of fellow Romans, you know, this policy. I think Dan Carlin called it like a double-edged sword, where like the clemency is what people are really afraid of. You know, when I read about that stuff, sometimes I really do think that this was, you know, just hating seeing your countrymen kill each other. And this is a sense of like, we are all, you know, we're going to reserve the right to fight amongst ourselves for power. But in the grand scheme of things, we're all Romans. And tribalism can be powerful that way. I think tribalism is part of what you're speaking to there, because it can't just be any man. It has to be a man that you identify with the qualities of, right?
Well, I think, you know, essentially, I think a lot of our modern condition is explained by World War II, and we see this energy and this tribalism that is put into following Hitler, and the world kind of decides, and in Japan, right, following the emperor, and the world kind of decides never again. Never again. And so all of our political and artistic energy is put into making sure this never happens again. And, you know, of course, like you look at the destruction that happens in World War II, and that reaction is very understandable. But I think, you know, ultimately, humans are pack animals, and just like wolves, we kind of thrive when there is an alpha that we can follow and one that leads and leads well. And so I think maybe to a certain extent, we threw the baby out with the bathwater when we took this extreme position against any sort of real leadership in the world.
Did we maybe take that position? I mean, I love that. There's so much there. But did we maybe take that because we decided that warfare and large-scale warfare was the worst possible outcome for humanity, and that that could be worse than maybe something similar to what we have today, which is a technocracy in which outcomes are deeply impersonal and conflict is considered to be some kind of third rail?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think, because of the specific experience of World War II, the aversion to war gets more severe the closer it gets to reminding you of World War II, if that makes sense. You know,
yeah, it's in the collective conscious and the id, and it just like the deepest of our paranoias.
Yeah, so like frankly, I think There's more tolerance of strong leaders the further you get away from Germany, frankly. Like a character like Lee Kuan Yew, who is a charismatic, strong leader, who takes full control of Singapore, that is kind of winked at and allowed because it feels far away enough from Germany that like, yeah, it doesn't feel the same. But if you frankly had a European Lee Kuan Yew, I think it would really freak some people out.
Yeah, I think that is, you can hear that in the voices of some of the people who have noticed that Trump, you know, America is pushing Europe to increase their military spending. You know, this was kind of, I think Germany increased their military spending by like a lot over the last 10 years, but now they're being asked to increase it by more. I mean, we're having these conversations right now. It is really interesting that some peoples on Earth use military power as a means for expansion, and that once they've started that out, this is just, you know, going to completely go to the edge. And it's interesting how the national conversations about this have evolved, about what exactly has happened. I don't know. Do you follow the podcast Daryl Cooper?
Yeah.
Okay. So I have had the opportunity to listen to some of his podcasts, and I have decided that he is a revisionist, to say the very least. There are parts of this narrative that are being presented now, though, that I feel like are these obvious repercussions of lionization of leaders. Like, the second you've set up, like, not to dispute anything about Winston Churchill's life in terms of his own self-reporting and, you know, what we do know about him. But there's almost a sense that once you set up good and evil on such strong terms, you're bound to have a pushback, even if the thing is that true.
Yeah. Well, I'm not the first one to make some critiques of Daryl Cooper. And frankly, I think he's a good podcaster on the things that he really researches and talks about. And so, I don't want to be overly critical of him. But I do think essentially what he did, I mean, especially if you look at some of his more glib statements that I think are not well thought out and he probably wishes he could have back. But, you know, he talks about Churchill looking for Hitler in hell in vain and stuff like that. And so I think he's taken this very, very strong reaction against what happened in World War II. And these people who want to, instead of it, you know, really getting to the details and understanding the conflict for what it was in all its intricacy and details and difficulties, they just want to portray it as Churchill is God and Hitler is the devil. And everything that the Allies did is unimpeachable, and everything that the Germans did is evil beyond comprehension. And, like, obviously there's enough there to make that a compelling story, which is why it's become sort of the dominant narrative. But Daryl Cooper just kind of wants to flip it around and actually, I think he sees it in more complexity than this, but at least maybe the way he initially portrayed it is as the poor benighted Germans seeking peace in vain and no one willing to understand them. And Churchill is this devil figure who wants to pursue war at all costs, when I think it's been 80 years, verging, you know, getting closer to 90 years since World War II. And I think it's time to just understand it on its own terms for what really happened and what it was, which is
I agree, a
complex conflict.
I agree entirely. I am willing to just kind of completely condemn Daryl Cooper, because I think he's lifting things from known agitators who are ahistorical. And it's sad in the context of a lot of his other podcast work that is in-depth and very insightful. It's strange that these kind of subterranean artifacts of, I just got to say it, neo-Nazism are making their way into this stuff. What I'm kind of saying is the way these histories are sometimes written, especially with someone like Winston Churchill, who, by the way, Winston Churchill is one of the great doers and one of the great, what are you going to say, writers. He wrote a lot. There's a lot of his writings that survive, and he writes this heroic history of Britain. You know, he writes the heroic histories of, you know, the first incursions by Vikings and pagans and all of this stuff. And so we know for a fact that there is a self-fulfilling, narcissistic maybe element in Winston Churchill, and I wouldn't deny that. But what we would also have to acknowledge is that there is a sober-minded perspective that sees a lot of this stuff as just being very far from being accurate. And I think that, you know, when you lionize these people, it's almost like you're begging the question. You know, Dan Carlin has, you know, I hate to quote him again, but like at the beginning of his podcast about Genghis Khan, he talks about, you know, the distance from the event, you know, determining exactly what the good and evil perspectives are on about it. You know, he writes that whole paper about how, you know, the tactics of the Mongols, and his, of course, his Chinese professor says, what about all the dead people? And I think that that is part of what's operating in some of these stories, when the emotional distance is so close to them, where, you know, there are people who are still alive who were, you know, involved in some of the events that are being discussed, you know, in World War II. And the idea that it wouldn't permeate into the collective consciousness of everyone who's, you know, talking about that is crazy, you know?
Well, look, I actually think what happened to Daryl Cooper is very understandable, because While I do agree with you, I also think this thing happens where you've been told that the truth is one thing, okay? The truth is that Hitler is the devil and Churchill is God's angel here to set things right. And then you read about the end of World War II and you realize that the war was really kind of over. And that a lot of what Churchill does at the end of the war is vindictive, right? And he firebombs German cities that have little strategic importance. And it is vindictive. And these are, you know, German civilians who probably never did an anti-Semitic act in their life, may or may not have supported Hitler in his rise. And they're dying in the most horrible ways imaginable, burning to death in these firebombings. And at any point, Churchill could have accepted a settled peace, stopped the Soviet incursion into Central Europe, and saved millions of lives, but chose not to because he was angry. And so I think, but you know, if you take a step back, then you see that, you know, like the other perspective, which is, yeah, you know, Hitler, time after time, had chances to stop and did not. And he invades Czechoslovakia, and he invades Poland, and he invades France, and he invades Austria. And each time people try and give him a pass, basically, and say, okay, you know, just knock it off. We don't want peace in Europe. And really, Hitler is, there's no other way to see it, Hitler is the chief antagonist and instigator of World War II and is ultimately responsible for all these millions and millions of deaths. Okay. But I think like what happens is you have been sold this story that only Hitler does bad things, the Allies do nothing wrong. And then you catch Churchill doing this really horrible thing. And you see this in like people who leave religions, right? That they believed in this thing, that everything about it was true, and then they find out that it's maybe not all true, or at least not in the simplistic kind of storybook way that they were told, and they become antagonists and have this total hatred towards the religion that they grew up with, to like a completely irrational and all-consuming degree. And I think that's like basically what you see here with someone like Daryl Cooper. And while it's maybe unfortunate, it's very understandable. And he seems to me that like is someone who is reasonable enough that he's, and maybe this process is already happening, is starting to come out in sort of a middle ground where he has this reaction of like, well, I was told that it was this way, and I'm so disenchanted that this isn't the truth that. You know,
I agree. It's I'm anger. Like, but
I'm
it's
on Hitler's
anger.
Side. But then I think he has this angry emotional reaction. But I think someone as smart as Cooper is going to come out in hopefully a more reasonable place.
Well, I agree, and I think that the anger there is, you know, even though I really really disagree with a lot of the things he said, and I hope he figures out how to correct some of this stuff. The anger is understandable because. The anger is something that I've felt a lot of the times, maybe just from, you know, frankly, just simple propaganda that I think I fell victim to when I was younger and I was more naive and I didn't think things through. I mean, one of the things I'm really angry about is, you know, I think that when I was growing up, I don't know what was going on, but the idea that weed was good for you was an important thing for everyone to find out who was 18. That the government was just trying right. to oppress you and, you know, keep you sober and, you know, whatever else. And that, like, everyone was coming after you for smoking weed for no reason. And it's turned out that that's been completely untrue. And, like, that's it's like, kind of just a basic propaganda point. But, I mean, the thing can be applied to anything you learn in history where there's a revisitation. And, I mean, the thing is, you build your identity around these things. A lot of people build identities mm-hmm. around big events. And they build identities, frankly, around the thing that you said earlier, which is like the person they follow. It can be shattering to people to find out that the person that they follow is some kind of monster. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons it makes it very hard for people who support Trump or, you know, any of these number of people to just notice the flaws, because so much of their identity is tied up in the following itself. So to finish up this podcast, this is actually just a perfect place to end. I'm just wondering what you think people can do to, you know, because your podcast, you've covered so much. You've been super duper prolific in the last, since I've spoken to you, which I guess was 2023. What can people do in their information diets in general to, you know, take in the things that are going to inspire them and help them grow as people, and also, you know, just try to maybe not avoid, but to better process the things about living in life that are so unheroic and that are so subterranean and awful?
So interesting question. So, you know, obviously I have sort of dedicated my career to surfacing the stories of great leaders throughout history. And so it's maybe not a surprise that I think that's like, should be the staple of anyone's information diet. But I think it's notable that someone like Machiavelli, sorry, my son just, speaking of my son, just tried to come say hi. But you know, someone as like Machiavelli says that this should be like the cornerstone, the pillar of a public education is reading, understanding the stories of these great leaders in history. And so I would say that, like, find those stories that resonate most with you and what you're trying to achieve in life, and you know, dive into them over and over again. In terms of like an actual news diet, I just think most people are not the exception. That is true of me and of you individually, Zeke, and of the listeners. Like, most of us are not the exception. And the rule is that the human mind is not equipped to deal with the modern media environment. Like,
I love that you said that. I love that you said that.
And like, just think about it. Pick any one group, okay? Latinos, blacks, Jews, Asians, Polynesians, Catholics, Protestants, anything. I can go out and find a dozen examples of any of those groups doing the most heinous acts to your people, whoever you consider to be your people, like, choose another one of those groups, right? In the past year, right? I could find a dozen examples of whites doing horrible things to blacks, Latinos, and vice versa. Blacks to whites, Latinos, Catholic, well, like, whatever, right? And of course, like, those are the things that generate news. And you see it now. Like, I think that there's a lot of fatigue. You saw this example, this woman that called the kid the N-word, and like, her GoFundMe has raised $600,000. You know what I'm talking about right now?
Yep. Zeke? Yes.
And I think it's just like, there's a lot of fatigue, specifically with blacks and the ways that they are perceived and portrayed. And so you see all these accounts that like amplify black crime, which there's plenty of to amplify. But like, you can get on that media diet, and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, you know, these, like, even someone like myself, you see it enough in your timeline, you're like, wow, what is going on with blacks in America? And sometimes, you know, whatever, there is like an underlying truth to maybe some of that. But then you do need to like get on the streets, and like, I go to church with black people and just like shake their hands and be like, okay, This is stuff that is happening on the fringes of actual human experience in any direction. And I think that explains like a lot of like conservatives that get tired of liberals, and they just get hyper focused on like black crime or Latino crime or illegal immigration. It also gets happens on the liberal side of like, of course, there are going to be real moments of actual racism against these minority groups and homophobia. But like, it gets way blown out of proportion by all of these people. And so I think there's just, if you see these stories, you are going to have a certain emotional reaction. Like, the answer is not to see all the stories and still tell yourself, okay, I'm going to not feel this way about the people that I see doing these horrible acts. It's like, no, you actually just have to turn it off. Because guess what? If I show you a timeline of insert group here committing horrible acts of violence against people that look like you, you are just going to have emotional feelings of disgust towards that group of people. And so just turn it off. Just turn it off. I think that's the answer.
Okay, excellent, Ben. Final question. Do you have three books you can recommend to listeners?
Yes. Number one, Education of a Bodybuilder by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Excellent. The second I second that.
The second half is just like a primer on how to bodybuild. And if you need that, then that's great. But, you know, but the first half is just him recounting his rise. And it's just a man in his moment of obsession. And you could, it's just like oozes with that feeling of enthusiasm and obsession. It's amazing. No book does more to get me fired up than reading and rereading The Education of a Bodybuilder. Number two, The Wright Brothers by David McCullough. Just, you read it and you're going to feel like you can run through a brick wall. What they did, the ingenuity, the just willingness to overcome any obstacle, it's just unbelievable. It's such a great story. I love that book, The Wright Brothers. And then the third, that's maybe somewhat similar to those two, is Endurance by Alfred Lansing. That's about what's his name, the captain of the Endurance. I gotta look it up. Why can I not think of his name? Shackleton, Ernest Shackleton.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Endurance by Alfred Lansing is one of the most, it was one of the best written books I've ever read. And just, again, if you're going through anything, reading that story just makes you feel like, all right, I can survive anything.
Yep.
And come out on top. So I would recommend those three.
All right. Well, this was excellent. I'm so glad you came on today, man. Everybody, Ben Wilson, founder of How to Take Over the World podcast. We're hoping to talk to you again soon, Ben. Thank you so much. Best of luck to you and your kids, and we will see you soon.
Zeke, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right.